Everybody, welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write for cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And this is Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. And this is our Escape from New York special. We'll be talking about the original John Carpenter classic, Escape from New York, from 81. And an Italian ripoff called 2019 After the Fall of New York, from 1983. Escape from New York. I remember, the very first episode of this podcast, we, talked about John Carpenter and we went through his whole career, and Escape from New York was my favorite then. And it still is of his entire oeuvre. And that's saying a lot, cause I love a lot of John Carpenter. And I don't quite know what it is, but, compared to his other movies that I like better, but just on its own merits, the concept alone is fantastic. And I used to get, even though I have always enjoyed the movie, I used to get hung up on the fact that, the New York, of this movie is nothing like New York, and they don't go out of their way to reference the fact that they're in New York, or go to New York landmarks or anything. But I still loved the movie, and I kind of came to realize that maybe what I love about the movie so much is the way it creates its own kind of sense of place, and with its own sense of rules and environment, independent of the fact that it's supposed to be New York City in the future, which has been turned into an abandoned prison colony. Because you watch the movie and it's a real place. They used a part of St. Louis where there had just been a huge fire, and they decorate the sets with trash and stuff, and everything about the fake New York and Escape from New York kind of feels like it's a real lived in place. And the actors, which I guess maybe is the more immediate reason I fell in love with the movie, the cast is just phenomenal, and all of the characters feel like they're really a part of this future world, whether they're on the outside of New York, like Lee Van Cleef as the prison warden, and of course Kurt Russell as the main anti-hero, Snake Plissken, but then Harry Dean Stanton, Adrian Barbeau, and Isaac Hayes, the three, who are all prisoner kind of characters that Snake meets inside there, they really feel like they've been a part of this world for a while. And, there's like there's little lines of dialogue and stuff that kind of hint at, I think William Gibson was once quoted as saying that he was inspired by a throwaway line.
Yeah.
In the scene where Lee Van Cleef is talking to Snake Plissken, and he tells Snake, you flew a glider over Leningrad in Siberia. And it's just this throwaway line that lets you know that, in the future we've actually been at war with Russia, like in a shooting war. And Gibson was inspired by that. He was inspired that, a throwaway line could do so much. And there's a lot of little, the more I watch the movie, the more I realize like how many little delicate little throwaway lines there are that tell you so much about this, about this science fiction future. And it's a tough movie to categorize. I mean, basically the other disappointment for this movie going into it, that's the most likely for people besides not having any real focus on the city of New York. The other thing that's most likely to disappoint people is that it's barely an action movie. Like, there is so very little action in it. And strangely enough, the action scenes aren't even, like, well done. Like, Carpenter has done some amazing action scenes in some of his movies, like Big Trouble in Little China especially, even though that was 5 years after this and he had learned more. But in Escape from New York, like, the action is very clunky and very minimal. And so it's hard to categorize it as an action movie. It's hard to categorize it as a science fiction movie because, you know, the first Mad Max is technically a science fiction movie, but it's in that little subgenre of science fiction called near future, where you're in the future a little bit enough for society to be turned upside down, but there's no futuristic technology or anything. And then you can't quite categorize it like as a... Well, I guess, you know, adventure kind of encompasses it all around. And I enjoy the fact that it's more of an adventure movie than an action movie. That it's really sort of like you're following Snake at all times, almost all times, on his odyssey through this strange place and finally back out. Oh, and as far as creating the sense of place, another big thing is the fact that there's a... Snake has a time limit on his mission, and he's got to go in and get out as quickly as possible. That kind of unifies everything, and it makes sure that it's an excuse not to have to like focus too much on, you know, exploring the ruined city of New York in the future, because he's in a hurry. He doesn't have time to sightsee, and Carpenter didn't have the budget to go sightseeing either. So it all just works out perfectly. Yeah, it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, you've listened to the commentary.
Uh-huh.
So every time I watch it, I saw the commentary. God, I think there was like a double VHS release or something that came out in about 95. And that was
right. It was letterboxed, and it had that deleted scene at the beginning where he gets arrested robbing a bank.
Yeah, so I mean, like, Escape from New York was probably... I mean, I think I'd seen The Thing, but Escape from New York was my first Carpenter movie, in a way. Because, I mean, The Thing is... You know, it's Carpenter with a huge... a limitless budget. It's totally different from this. But, I mean, just the... John Carpenter audio commentaries, by the way, especially of his 70s work... And this are, you know, the best filmmaker commentaries there are. And so watching the beginning, I remembered where he made all the fades and the cuts to sort of create the illusion of the Liberty Island base.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what he does in the first... It's like 20, 25 minutes before Snake even gets to the island, right? And then it's, you know, almost, another 20 minutes before Snake hooks up with Adrian Barbeau and Harry Dean Stanton. And he meets Ernest Borgnine. But a significant chunk of the movie is basically Snake by himself moving around. And it's a very interesting movie right there because... You know, Escape from New York is this classic, and I would say it's not an influential classic, though.
Why not?
Nobody else has ever done anything like this. I don't think anybody has ever done a movie plotted like Escape from New York. Where you had the hero, not really a hero, you established that right away... With the famous "Ain't My Wife" scene where he watches the girl get raped, you know, Ernest Borgnine. I always want to know what Cabby did to get there, and you know it's something off. It's like he dismembered kids or something. It's something awful.
Well, I'll just mention right now that I have read, I do own and have read the novelization.
And what do you do?
Evidently he was just boarded up. He didn't want to leave the city when they put up walls. He was just too dedicated to being a cabbie.
But the beginning, back to the whole budget thing. The beginning, I think, Carpenter does more with... I can't even imagine how much the models cost just at the beginning. And some of that could have just been matte paintings.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a very famous matte painting shot in this movie that we of course, have to talk about. but I think that that opening that looks as good as anything else, right? The way the movie's plotted after that, he doesn't have to show that again. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So when I was more hung up on, you know, the movie being more about New York, like, it disappointed me that the models and the matte paintings of the New York City skyline are so incredible, and then there isn't a reason to go back to them again once he's inside the city.
Yeah, I think that it's to sell you on it. Then once you're there, you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you're in the story and suspension of disbelief that this burnout,
probably the one place that he could have used it and didn't because of budget would have been, if there had been some background view of the city when they're, driving out on the bridge at the very end.
The famous 69th Street Bridge.
Right. Which doesn't exist.
Which everyone should visit when in New York. Head to the 69th Street Bridge.
Yeah. There's a 59th Street Bridge, but I guess they thought it would be funnier to call it the 69th Street Bridge. And also that way their bridge could look like whatever. It's the only two-lane bridge in the whole city.
Yeah, only two-lane bridge that looks somewhat rural in all of New York. But, you know, and 69th isn't really high enough for that to be plausible. I mean, you could go higher and higher, and maybe it would be. But the thing is the 69th Street Bridge, you never really know the geography of the movie because it doesn't really take place in New York. There's an implication that there's a Central Park scene, but it has nothing to do with Kurt Russell.
Oh, you know what? We're wrong. There is, in that scene, there is a background, like, matte painting of buildings. And it's flawless. it flawlessly looks like there are really tall buildings behind where all these prisoners are waving their arms for one of the police
helicopters. That's the matte painting I'm talking about, though. That one.
What?
That's the Cameron matte painting.
Oh, okay.
The Central Park one, that's the Cameron matte painting. Oh, I thought you meant the bridge. I'm like, there was? No, yeah, the that scene.
No, the bridge could have used one.
The bridge could have used one, yeah. Yeah, that's the Jim Cameron matte painting. That's how Jim Cameron got his start. He painted mats for Roger Corman, and then he got onto this. And
yeah, the miniatures models are credited to New World Pictures, which was Corman's outfit at the time.
The thing about Escape from New York is the production designer is Joe Alves, who worked with
Joe Alves worked with Spielberg a couple times on Jaws 2, Close Encounters.
Yeah, I mean, so he's like, well, I mean, this is where Dean Koontz got his start. Dean Koontz, of course. I mean, and the Dean Koontz in this, and if you can see the Blu-ray Escape from New York, you should, because, you know, Dean Koontz, they created a lens for Dean Koontz here. So you got this $8 million, you know, who even released Escape from New York when AFCO Embassy released it. Coca-Cola released this movie, right? And it's Dean Koontz shooting it, and
it's not just that the cinematography is so sharp and that he had a special lens made to shoot with really low light. It's that combined with a production design, like, Escape from New York just has this unified style where, like, everything stylistically about it, from the costumes to the buildings to the detail, like, you know, the font on the computers and stuff, it's really color it looks like a living comic book or something. Like, the color, the use of color to create this kind of cool blue and neon, and, you know, kind of like kind of earth tones almost for the prisoners. It's just got this flawless style. And that as much as anything else kind of contributes to the feeling of it taking place in the future, much like Mad Max, where like because of the direction and the costume design, it's kind of, you know, that implies the future more than anything else. It's like using your, it's creatively implying the future when you don't have any robots or anything.
Right. And I mean, in this one, you know, you do have the Gulfstream glider, which is a really funny sequence because I'd sort of forgotten how it gets into the air. And it gets taken up just by a propeller, a prop
plane.
Yeah.
It gets pulled by another plane.
And you can see that it's, you know, they're going to the airfield. It's just some airfield where they did this shot.
Right.
And so, but they're still able to sell it, you know. I mean, it's, you're, because the cool thing about the Liberty Islands exterior set, which was probably filmed in L.A.,
it looks like it was filmed in one of the L.A. basins.
Exactly. And I mean, they have all these helicopters around. So there's this the helicopter shot at the beginning. I think that's where it sells it.
Oh, where the helicopter fires rockets on the two prisoners trying to rowboat their way out.
When they go in for the president and you have the fleet of helicopters going into the city.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That is just this beautiful shot in this movie that costs nothing, right?
The helicopters heading towards a matte painting and then cut to helicopters landing in the middle of their St. Louis location.
But that was, how many helicopters were there? I mean, because they just kept coming and there must have been 9 helicopters. So those had to be models, right?
Probably. I know the helicopter. There's like a helicopter model before that in the scene I just mentioned. But you know, the helicopters are, you know, the fact that everything about the United States Police Force, USPF, it's all black. You know, black helicopters, black glider, black uniforms on Lee Van Cleef. Also, like, I was wrong. They don't cut straight from black choppers to St. Louis. They cut from black choppers to a computer screen with that kind of black and green, you know, wireframe graphical style of the early 80s that people associated with computers. And that creates the impression of the future, too. And they use, you know, the fake wireframe of the city, which was like another model city with like green electrical tape all over it. It's stunning how many tricks this movie has and how good they all are and how they all add to a sense of, you know, otherworldliness.
Right.
In this future, if a plane were crashing into a building, you know, the guys in charge would be like watching a digital representation of that plane crashing into a digital representation of the building. And that's how they do it, because they don't have the budget to crash a real plane. But, like, you know, goddamn if that doesn't sell you on it and bring you a little bit more into this world just through a little more, you know, art design, a little more clever production design.
Yeah, apparently that's sort of what Alv started with Spielberg, was mats and models. And so once you get Snake into the city, you don't really have any more
it all goes away.
You don't have any more of the I'm trying to think, is there a single model shot after Snake gets into the city?
No, I don't think so. There's a matte shot in the Central Park scene, but that's about it that I can think of, and I've seen this movie a lot.
And so, well, maybe there's a matte shot with the museum. I don't know. Maybe they, or the library, maybe they could have found just a library in St. Louis.
No, that was a real building.
So yeah, and then Snake gets there and he's by himself for, it really feels like about 20 minutes.
Yeah, at least, yeah.
And so, I mean, you're talking about an action sci-fi movie where the advertising poster is the Statue of Liberty's head on the street, basically doing the pianist, right? Like, one guy by himself for an extended period of time. And you don't really get much off of Snake Plissken. You know, it's not like he's a tortured soul who it's interesting to watch his expressions or something. It's just this really quiet hour and a half, or how, I mean, I'm sure you could figure out how long it's supposed to be because he's got the timer and he's just kind of walking around and seeing what's going on. And I think that's where Escape from New York is really establishes itself. As, I mean, you know, the Carpenter got away with that. That he did that successfully. Because he's never, you know, I mean, the thing about Carpenter is that usually when he's doing his great stuff, it's stuff that he's never done again or before. And that when he returns to something, like with Ghosts of Mars, which you don't like and I find amusing, you know, it's amusing. But, I mean, that sequence where, you know, the chock full of nuts, just all of that, it's, and the chock full of nuts is interesting because it's after the theater. So you've already met Ernest Borgnine. So, basically, Kurt Russell gets there, walks around a bit, doesn't have any encounters. Does he have an encounter with the street people before he gets to the theater?
No. Although I'll mention that he, in the script, and it survives in the novelization, he was supposed to have a little bit of a scrape with some guys at the World Trade Center on his way out, but I don't think they had the money for it, and that's why it just kind of fades from him in the World Trade Center when someone darts behind him.
Right.
It just fades from that to him walking down the street.
And so he's walking, and he investigates the plane. He looks at the plane, and so
and there's guys and there's guys running around, but they're not even interested in him.
Right,
and that's what's so
freaking creepy about it.
Yeah,
it's just, I mean,
I love the idea that if New York were turned into a prison island and people had to live there the rest of their days, like they wouldn't necessarily be like a lot of them wouldn't really like be motivated enough to join a gang or something. Like they just kind of hang out. I mean, that's what they're doing at the theater. They're hanging out, watching a show.
Yeah.
There's that hilarious shot that introduces Ernest Borgnine where like everyone in the audience looks so miserable except for Ernest Borgnine who's tapping his head along to the beat.
Well, and then there's the whole thing of Ernest Borgnine wouldn't have been in that neighborhood usually. He just wanted to catch the show that night. And so, I mean, that establishes not just that it's a special event, but it also establishes that there's other stuff going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that he has a life outside. And this is the thing that I think...
Snake Plissken in my cab. Wait till I tell Eddie. Like, well, who's Eddie?
Right.
Doesn't matter.
And so, I mean, the thing is that I think that is... You know, so it's basically, in some ways, Carpenter's career, what is it, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog, this, and The Thing are all like one set of Carpenter's career.
Yeah.
And in some ways it culminates with The Thing because that's him sort of doing all this stuff in a huge budget. And when I say huge budget, I don't even mean special effects with The Thing. I mean that he's able to do it in an Arctic setting, you know, whatever, just the film, the production values. And then there's a dramatic shift after that, you know, there's the break. Christine
and Starman. And signal then, a definite new phase in his career.
Yeah. And then since then it's like everything's hit and miss. And I mean, there's great stuff in Christine.
True.
You know, I mean, there's really great stuff in Christine, but it's like when I heard they were remaking, I'm like, God, I hope Carpenter's, you know, ready to remake his own movie because he could do a great job with that one. But I mean, some of Christine's great, but it's just the script's not there. This stuff is this sort of, I mean, it's like Spielberg, you know, there's the Spielberg of Sugarland, Jaws, and Close Encounters is totally different than the Spielberg of 1941 and Raiders of the Lost Ark and everything since then. There's a distinct Carpenter feel to these. And it's also in the script. And it's in what the script is able to do. Like, I mean, we haven't even gotten to Brain yet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the script, you're right, is really kind of unique. And I love the fact that not only do you have the 20 minutes of mostly silently following Kurt Russell as he wanders around, but after kind of an interlude with Harry Dean Stanton and Adrian Barbeau, where he forces them to help him, he gets captured, and then by Isaac Hayes, and then by the time he gets out of Isaac Hayes's clutches, it's like these other, you know, Adrian Barbeau and Harry Dean Stanton have been plotting something else behind his back, and rescuing Donald Pleasance. And so, like, everything just kind of comes together, so that like it feels like a really, it feels like every by the time he's driving Ernest Borgnine's cab out of New York City with Borgnine and Barbeau and Stanton, and they're being chased by Duke, like everything has led up really logically to this point that culminates with like Isaac Hayes chasing him over the wall out of the city. And like by that point, like I think I remember the very first time I saw this, I was like, the movie does a slow burn on you. Because the first half an hour is very, very slow, but it's stylized with, you know, the matte paintings and everything and the music, and you're drawn into it and everything just clicks so that you're really excited by the time that Kurt Russell's trying to get over that wall at the end. Not to mention he only has like 30 seconds or whatever.
Yeah, he's about to die.
Before the poison they injected with him takes effect.
And okay, well, we spoil everything. So, I wasn't thinking this time watching it ahead. I wasn't anticipating things. Mm-hmm. So, when Donald Pleasance,
As the President of the United States,
shoots the Duke.
Yeah.
It is, I think that might be the movie's greatest scene. Just in what it does.
It takes
the movie away from the hero, who's too sick to do anything at this point. Like, he can't beat Isaac Hayes at this point.
He's literally a sitting duck.
And then the President of the United States, who we have seen, you know, be tortured. We've seen him be
a sniveling coward at the hands.
Sniveling coward. He started as a shithead politician.
Right.
And now he grabs a machine gun and blows away.
Yeah, maniacally.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just somehow just freaking beautiful. And I mean, that's what this movie is. It has so many beautiful moments in it. Like, well, when Adrian Barbeau gives up.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, because that's the funny thing is that Kurt Russell doesn't have a love interest in this.
Yeah, it's funny that she doesn't have really an incentive to help Snake anymore. If anything, if her only goal is to get off the island, she should just keep going. But we kind of buy that, you know.
Yeah.
She was in love with Harry Dean Stanton, so now that he's dead, she's just going to help Snake.
Even though earlier, there was these looks between Adrian Barbeau and Snake because at that point, Brain was sort of she was taking care of him. She was basically his wet nurse. And I mean, that's the thing is Harry Dean Stanton gets the only, I think, does he get the only one? The Harry Dean Stanton is Brain. In the opening credits, is he the only special credit?
I'm not sure. It might have been him and Barbeau as Maggie.
Yeah, but, well, I think it's just and Adrian Barbeau. I don't think it's as Maggie.
Well, it's Harry Dean Stanton's probably best performance after Repo Man, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, well, Harry Dean Stanton, it was after Alien, so he was. And that's the crazy thing about this cast is that Carpenter hasn't, you know, the Fog
each,
had a
each one of them is kind of a character actor at their peak,
right? I mean, like, you know,
of their character actor career.
Okay, so you know,
down to the guy who plays the Duke's right hand man, who was one of the gang members in Assault on Precinct 13, the one who shoots the little girl.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that's kind of the thing is though. What I think that this one and The Fog and The Thing really show that Carpenter's really good with casts of five characters or so. And he just doesn't do it.
Yeah, it's too much work now.
Yeah, well, I mean, he didn't do it after this.
Yeah,
I mean, he kind of did in Big Trouble in Little China. He had four people there.
Yeah.
But not in the same way.
Prince of Darkness had a few people, but...
Prince of Darkness, yeah.
It's just not the same. It's just not as important. It's just not as important as Escape from New York, where while the main character is incapacitated, the supporting characters are like actively moving the plot along and changing things. And there's, you know, double crosses and triple crosses.
And they're taking place off screen for the most part. I mean, so the scene we're
it's that sense of place thing again.
Is this Kurt Russell gets knocked out, and he takes longer to wake up than pretty much everybody else who could have been knocked out, or maybe they believed brain and didn't knock him out. But well, that's the other thing that I really like about it is that with brain and the Duke,
yeah,
you always believe that that's Duke's thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you really don't see any evidence of Brain being that smart.
Well, he did get that diagram of the bridge.
He did get the diagram of the bridge, but that, you know...
that really
somebody else made it.
That inaccurate...
Oh, yeah, the inaccurate diagram of the bridge. We find out at the end it's completely inaccurate. But, you know, so the scene where the double crosses happen is Kurt Russell's in the middle of the big fight scene. He's fighting, you know, what's his name? Masher Dasher from Beyond Thunderdome.
Yeah.
Master Blaster from Beyond Thunderdome. I mean, he's in a ring, right. He's fighting this guy. Well, completely independent of him, your supporting cast is you know, taking the president, who Kurt Russell is there to rescue, away from him, not letting him know. This isn't a team. They aren't, you know, there's no team here. The allegiance is
constantly shifting.
I don't know if they ever constantly shifting. I think that it becomes clear that the Duke of New York is not someone that Brain and Maggie want to deal with anymore.
Yeah.
And that's why they're receptive to Snake at the beginning. And the other thing is, the famous cutscene of this movie is Snake running away and getting busted for the bank robbery.
Mm-hmm.
And,
which, by the way, does have, like, a stupid little Roomba robot vacuum cleaner thing in it, and would have destroyed the integrity of this not having any stupid future stuff in it.
Yeah. And the thing about not having it in it...
Oh, and they're stealing, like, credit... We're just stealing, like, futuristic credit things instead of
it's something
money.
That I run away with Tom Selleck. You know, it's crap. Whatever. Because what they do with the opening now is, and I just thought of this a couple minutes ago. Have you seen Gattaca?
Yeah, long time ago.
Gattaca's, you know, it's a future movie with lots of future crap, like cloning, right? But there's not really a lot of future stuff in it. It establishes it by telling you it's the future, doing some things to establish it's the future, and then just not breaking the rules it sets for itself. which is basically what Escape from New York does. And that opening with the room. See, I always thought that that cutscene was had something to do with Harry Dean Stanton, and it actually doesn't. Harry Dean Stanton sold Snake out on an earlier heist.
Right.
So that's how I got to that tangent. But yeah, no, if you'd opened with that, it just would have... Because the first 20 minutes of the movie aren't about Snake Plissken.
It takes long enough for Snake to get in New York anyways.
It takes long enough for him to get into the movie. I mean, if you think about it.
Yeah.
He gets the prisoner's walk, and then it's Lee Van Cleef's show for a bit.
Yeah, that's true.
With Charles Cypher showing up and Tom Atkins for their stuff. And more, I like that
more Carpenter synergy.
At the end with Tom Atkins, I kind of felt like they made a cut of him talking to Snake. But maybe
because of the
didn't.
Way he looked at him.
Yeah. Mm. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, the movie has its fantastic ending.
Right. And excuse me. One more thing about the unified style. Forgot to mention Carpenter's music. The fact that it's, you know, he'd been working like with synthesizers and the scores for Halloween and The Fog and Assault on Precinct 13, but Escape from New York is massively. It's like almost it's all synthesizer, and that's, you know, that was kind of a futuristic thing at the time in 81. Like the use of synthesizer music implied a future. You know, even before Tron, even. This movie came out before Tron.
I know, and that's what I was thinking about with the wireframe buildings. Where, you know, they were taping up boxes, right?
Right,
and Tron
right.
was doing it on the computer, and yeah. And unfortunately, we've gone the way that Tron gets a big sequel.
Yeah. But great music. Probably my favorite Carpenter score as well as movie.
I think that might be the thing that also sets the thing apart. He doesn't do the music.
Yeah, he lets Ennio Morricone.
And it's a great. I love it, the score to the thing, but it's. You know, it's.
It's not as melodic as.
The thing soundtrack is an album on itself. I mean, I don't know if you have it, but.
No.
If you read the track listings, it's pretty clear that you can sit and be depressed listening to the thing music without watching the movie. In fact, it might even be more depressing. I mean, because the movie's at least got action and some comedy in it. And, but no, his music here is the crazy thing about Escape from New York is it's quiet. It's occasionally sublime.
It's frequently sublime. You know, like, they're talking about remaking it now, and of course they'll get around to it. But the thing about it is, you know, going back to the not being about New York, is that, like, when they make it now, they're going to do everything that Carpenter wouldn't have done anyways, even if he had had the budget on it. Like, you're going to have, you know, CG cities and will constantly be reminded of the size of the city as Gerard Butler walks through it as Snake.
Oh, he's not going to do it anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But, you know, what I'm saying is you're going to have at least one shot where, like, probably where, you know, as soon as Snake gets there, like, they'll have the shot where the camera starts on him and then it starts pulling out and it pulls out further and further and you see the whole city kind of, you know, eclipse around him.
We've had that now at least two times that I can think of in the last 15 years. The empty New York streets. The CGI created empty New York streets. We've had Vanilla Sky did it, and
it's
I
just,
Am Legend
yeah.
did it.
Wait, what am I saying? It's going to look like I Am Legend. Yeah.
They remake Escape from New York, it's going to look like I Am Legend. Hell, they'll probably put zombies in it. I mean, One of the selling points of the remake, as I remember reading about it the last time that anybody talked about it, was they actually were going to have the Statue of Liberty's head in the middle of New York, which is out of Planet of the Apes. I mean, it's it's what happens at the end of Spaceballs or something. I mean,
they're gonna put the giant pair of handcuffs on the Statue of Liberty's arm, like the other Escape from New York poster.
That was a cool poster. I remember that one.
Yeah.
No, it's you can't but remake it. You could never remake this.
Yeah, you could never remake it, but I mean, they will. But it's going to be even more egregious than any other Carpenter remake because, you know, for all the stylization I've been talking about, it's just the most Carpenter movie. Like people like to say Carpenter is one of those directors who's got such a style that you can tell within a few minutes that you're watching a Carpenter movie. This is the most recognizable Carpenter movie by whatever standards you use to pinpoint Carpenter's style.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I could go on. How much more time do we have?
We've already ran over a little.
All right.
Is there anything
well,
we've missed? A little bit about the plane scene, because we did Airplane last time. So.
Yeah. They have the
airplane coming through the sky, and it's got to be one of the big effect shots. And it looks about as good as, I mean, probably not as good as, say, Superman with its fake plane, but it looks, you know, really good. And then, of course, you know, once Carpenter gets into the interior, he sells it, and so you're not... It's kind of funny. Once he gets into the interior of an effect shot, he never goes back outside again. Except at the beginning with the bridge. It opens with the escape attempt. These two guys on a raft. They don't really give them enough time to turn around, I noticed this time.
It kind of seems like they're still rowing the same direction, but honestly, like, the helicopter's blowing them around. They could have been trying to turn it around before they blew them up. Yeah. They just wanted to blow them up.
This is one of the things that's never really touched on in Escape from New York. It doesn't really sound like you'd want to live in the future.
Right. Well, like the opening narration explains, the crime rate has skyrocketed, and that's why. I mean, if this has happened to New York, then the rest of the country can't be doing too good.
No, and we're at war with China and Russia now. Nah, it probably really sucks. But anyway. Yeah. Then after this shot of the raft getting blown up, which, you know, was probably shot on a lake in St. Louis, we go back to this great match shot of the helicopter flying around one of the bridges. And because that's still in that establishing opening. And I mean, this is the movie where I think more than any other Carpenter, you wonder what he could do. And we've talked about this before. I think we talked about it on the first episode, all the stuff he turned down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just that simple one shot there, it makes you wonder what he could have done with any of those big blockbusters of this era that he turned down.
Yeah.
And so, this would be a good segue because... I think the next movie opens sort of across the bridge from New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. 2019 after the fall of New York. The first shot is the only shot, the only special effects shot that they have of New York in this rip-off of Escape from New York, is a completely decimated skyline and, you know, some buildings. And it kind of looks like, well, I mean, the city's supposed to have been nuked in the future. It hasn't been turned into a prison. It was just blown up and there's some people living there still. But, the city kind of looks like, remember the beginning of Monty Python's Meaning of Life, that short, the Crimson Permanent Assurance, where the buildings were like, they the people turn their building into a ship with sails, and it starts sailing through other buildings. It looks like that, except really bad and really, really obviously just a tiny, like, model made of egg cartons that they're panning the camera through. And when they do get into New York in this movie, it's just like, it just looks like any abandoned lot with some buildings in it.
And horses.
Yeah. I mean, you know how, like, when Snake goes into the library, it really look that the room that Barbeau and Stanton are in, it really looks like they've been living in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing in this looks like anybody's been living there at all. And yeah, I mean, where to begin? Instead of Escape from New York establishes that it's a prison through narration, and then it shows prisoners try to escape and get blown up by one of those choppers. After the Fall of New York opens with narration about an even more elaborate future where nuclear war has happened and the two world powers are the Uraks, who are a European, African, Chinese association, and the good guys, the New Republic, whatever.
The Americans, basically.
Yeah, the Americans, basically. And the Uraks... And the Uraks are represented by these, well, they're black clad, like the USPF and Escape, but they get around on horseback, which kind of makes sense, you know, in the apocalyptic future. But they also have flamethrowers, so it's like if they have fuel for flamethrowers, but they can't use the, they got to use horses. Anyways, they kind of go on an extermination mission at the beginning. They ride into New York on horseback, and they're, like, flaming people who have been irradiated by the fallout, who have pretty disgusting-looking facial prosthetics. Some of the effects in this movie are good, actually.
The whole model shot, the first time they do it, it was pretty good.
Well, the skyline kind of looks okay, yeah. But when they bring the camera through there, it looks bad. Anyways, they cut from this kind of you know, like, Cossack genocide stuff to our hero, who is definitely cast for his resemblance to. Wait,
you skipped my favorite part about the beginning.
Oh, what?
The trumpeter.
Oh yeah, I was wondering if I should mention that or not.
Yeah, because that's how you know it's really New York, because there's a black guy there.
Because there's a black guy.
There's one black guy in the movie, and you know he has, you know, he's like a Disney character. You know, trumpet, and it's just what I love about this movie is it's made in Italy, right? If it's played in the United States, it played in L.A. and New York and maybe Chicago, right? And it played late at night, right? So nobody was going to freaking see this out on this continent.
Yeah.
Yet the Americans are the heroes. They go to Alaska at some point.
Yeah, the president's
hiding out in Alaska.
Yeah. I thought that was weird too, like that the Uraks are the bad guys, that all the European countries are now the fascists. Well, I mean, they were always the fascists, but yeah, it's oddly anti-European for a
European movie.
Italo-Frenchy production, as the opening titles say.
But I'm sorry, I interrupted you before you got to the Road Warrior part, so please continue.
Yeah. Our Snake Plissken surrogate is introduced doing car battle in the Nevada desert, dueling. And, you know, the cars are all tricked out Road Warrior style. And, I mean, this movie kind of benefits from having been made after the Road Warrior, because there were also a lot of Italian Road Warrior ripoffs. So this one kind of gets to be a ripoff of Road Warrior and Escape from New York. And, the scene where, I'm not going to call him, his real name is, the character's name is Parsifal, right? Doesn't quite have the same ring as Snake,
no.
But Parsifal, the scene where he's driving this car, dueling the other guy in the car, is pretty well shot. And it's done to establish that he can that he can drive for their daring escape at the end of the movie, you know, which they steal from Escape. But the other thing about this scene that introduces Parsifal is that we see other denizens of the post-apocalyptic future, and some of them just look like, you know, like punks that they picked up out of local bars. But then other characters have post-apocalyptic clothing, which is more outlandish and goofy than any of the clothes that they wore in The Road Warrior or in Escape from New York. And it really, also when they get inside New York, I mean, the costume design in this movie really made me appreciate how down to earth Escape from New York's costume design is by comparison, because in Escape from New York, like, yeah, Isaac Hayes is wearing like the, you know, Napoleon jacket, but everything everybody's wearing could have conceivably been, you know, salvaged or something. There's no reason why the guy who gives Parsifal his winnings in Fall of New York has to be wearing a hat that's half of a top hat and half of a bowler hat sewn together. It's like, wow, what a dark future. Nobody even has a whole hat.
And of course, Parsifal is a hero, though.
He's more heroic than Snake.
Yes. He releases his winnings, which partially are some woman.
Oh, he wins this disgusting whore. But he gives her freedom.
Was she supposed to be disgusting? I never can tell with Italian movies.
No, I don't think she was, but she is.
Okay. He lets her go. She rides off on horseback. I thought he was going to shoot her for some reason, you know?
This movie's got a weird conception of the future because, like, yeah, there's been nuclear war and stuff, but unlike the ravaged futures of The Road Warrior and Escape from New York, they still have the technology in After the Fall of New York to have, like, hovercrafts. Like, Parsifal is approached by a hovercraft that just, like, pops up over him, like a Vogon ship or something.
Yeah,
And they talk to him over loudspeaker or something, or they just radio into his bike radio.
You know what this movie kind of reminded me of a lot?
What?
Zardoz.
It does have certain allusions. I wouldn't say it's rich in satire, though.
No, it just...
I think what you're getting at is the fact that Snake has to go into New York... I'm sorry, Parsifal has to go into New York to get the last fertile woman on Earth.
And that's when I realized
Not the president.
That Children of Men.
Yeah,
movie,
Children of Men
the
stole
novel
this.
Too, stole it. But apparently, according to the trivia, Children of Men makes homage to 2019, the movie, anyway. I don't know about the novel.
What? Really? What?
They use the painting a lot, and apparently the motif of the car door as a weapon is repeated.
Wait a minute. They use Guernica?
Yeah, throughout. I haven't seen Children of Men.
I can't believe it.
Yeah, so more frightening is that they're aware of 2019.
Exactly. I can't believe that.
But I guess it's better they were aware of it than they just, you know, totally.
Well, it's not like, you know, global infertility is, you know, it's not like more than a few science fiction writers haven't used that concept before. It's just the fact that makers of Children of Men had to get it from this movie.
Well, I kind of thought that, well, Children of Men's based on a novel, but I thought, I haven't seen it or read it. So doesn't he have to go into some certain city to find her or something, the last fertile woman? And this one's kind of funny because, you know, it's like in the last 15 years, everybody sort of realized that monkeys are really funny. But in this movie, monkeys aren't really funny, but midgets are. So you have like this midget who shows up.
But it has midgets and monkeys. It's like the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, not since Warwick Davis has there been such a lovable midget as there is in this movie.
Shorty, what else?
And he almost gets beaten to death, and they have to save him because they're going to beat him up because he wasn't a kid. And, I mean, that's like the crazy stuff about it is every once in a while there'll be something in it like, no, yeah, that makes total sense. That's pretty good. Like, yeah, I totally buy that. Like, a bunch of vicious people are going to try and kill a midget because for a second they thought he was a young boy and nobody had seen a young boy in, you know, 15 years. And so the crowd goes nuts and they're going to kill him. And I'm like, yeah, that makes...
The crowd is out on their daily rat hunting patrol.
In one warehouse or another. I mean, that's the best part about once they get to New York. It's basically
New York is just a series of warehouses and junkyards. Yeah.
Yeah. The scene where he lies about who the last fertile woman is, too, that was, you know, pretty good. Because I'm sitting there like, no, he didn't. Was I not paying attention? Like, she never told him that. And then it's like, ah. And then it comes up again later. So I don't know what else is in the... It's not like the director made a career out of doing these knockoffs, so...
Unfortunately. Yeah, Zardoz.
I think when I say it reminded me of Zardoz, it... In some of the weirdness, in the intentional weirdness, where in Zardoz it was intentional, but in this it was just sort of this hodgepodge of... It's like these guys saw the Zardoz preview and were like, hey, we should put that in. Maybe it was the horses. Weren't there horses in Zardoz, you know? Yes, there were. There were horses.
Sean Connery on a horse, yeah.
Sean Connery on a horse. And they got horses here. It's like... You know, imagine Willow in the future or something. You
well,
know,
it's hard. I mean, it's hard for there to be unintentional weirdness in a movie that's a post-apocalyptic combination ripoff of Road Warrior and Escape from New York. But they do manage to do some stuff that's even... This isn't unintentional, but they do manage to do some stuff that's even weirder than what either of those movies had. Mainly the monkeys, which we just alluded to. Late... In the movie, Parsifal and his ragtag group come across a gang of people who have apparently began mutating into monkeys, de-evolving. And some of them just have monkey-like facial makeup, but others are like actual monkey-faced people. And then their leader ends up joining the group and trying to escape from New York. And rescuing the last fertile woman on Earth. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the monkey people, though, it's...
By that point in the movie, you're just like, all right, whatever. You've seen so much craziness so far.
Like, oh, we gotta throw in the,
So, like, another thing that they pile on to this, you know, future of all post-apocalyptic futures... is that there are cyborgs, and it's kind of like barely mentioned at the beginning, but then it turns out after Parsifal and his girlfriend and the one of the two guys that the feds sent him in to New York with, who has an eye patch, by the way, just like Snake, the guy with the eye patch turns out to be a cyborg, and as soon as Parsifal figures him out, hey, you're a cyborg, they have to fight to the death. And I didn't quite catch why that was. Did you? Well,
I think it was because the cyborg had not revealed that he was... No, because the president knew he was a cyborg. Right?
Right. So, I mean...
Well, there was something wrong with the cyborgs. That was one of the Unix or UNAX problems, was that they were using cyborgs. For some reason, I thought that the cyborg was going to like try and go to Alpha Centauri with them and infiltrate... I guess
that would explain it if only the Urex used cyborgs, but then how would the Americans not know?
No, the Urex didn't use cyborgs.
Oh.
They had a problem with the Americans for using cyborgs. And all the cyborgs were supposed to be destroyed or something.
Oh, so it's like a Blade Runner thing?
Yeah, except you gotta... Did you watch the new Battlestar Galactica?
No.
Okay, for people who watch the new Battlestar Galactica, the cyborg in this is Doc Cottle from that. So basically a mid-50s, kind of heavy, gray-haired, you know, looks like your doctor on a TV show cyborg. This isn't a freaking action hero. It's the most ludicrous thing in the world. You know, he's the most deadliest killer in the world. And I mean, that's when I knew this movie had major problems, just was going to be a treat, was when the president of the United States in his secret Alaskan base tells our hero that he's got to go in with two people to complete his mission.
Yeah, one of whom, the other one of which has a robot hand.
Because the UNAX took his hand.
Yeah, but then he uses it to gouge out the eyes of one of the UNAX when they get captured.
And I think they even say that. He's like, this is why I have this hand.
Yeah. The thing about like the good guys, you know, in Alaska and the Urex and their base is that their costume designs, I mean, like all the henchmen, the ones who rode in on horses, like they all have capes. So when they show you the future in this movie, it's probably more like Flash Gordon than anything else. The Dano De Laurentiis Flash Gordon that we just watched.
You know, I wanted to say that during Escape from New York. You know, Carpenter at $8 million, he made, you know, that look good. I mean, imagine if he'd done Flash Gordon, right? But anyway.
Oh, yeah.
There's no real good tone to this future, because then the monkey men come in, and
yeah, it's just sort of whatever futury stuff they could think of, whether it gelled or not, it's all in there.
And then when you get to, oh god, when they get to the last woman on Earth, it's not the female lead. It's some unconscious girl.
Right.
And they explain how it's going to be okay because, you know, they're going to pull out all of her eggs, right?
Yeah.
And that's how they're going to harvest her eggs, and then we'll be able to repopulate the species on Alpha Centauri. But when they get there, she's like in a cave.
She's on life support in a cave somehow.
And her dad had her on life support. And basically what he – and you know, the story of – why she's like this, it makes sense. It's like her father knew it was coming, and so he like induced her into a coma and protected her air supply so she wouldn't catch anything and she'd be okay. And but they're gonna, the transportation system to carry her is a station wagon,
just like the car that Snake steals midway through Escape.
Yeah, and then I love the how the last fight scene takes place in the desert with mountains around.
Yeah, it's really jarring after all that fake New York stuff.
Yeah, because it's like, how far did you guys drive? You know, do you drive faster in the future in station wagons? Did you notice, though, it wasn't during that shot, but it was at the beginning. No, there are no filming locations on IMDb. Either they had a matte painting of Monument Valley, or
I think it sort of looked like they were in Monument Valley.
And
that looks real
to me. Leone came over from Monument Valley with Once Upon a Time in the West. I think some other guys did from the European Westerns, so maybe they did. And it's just kind of crazy that.
Yeah,
that's like
definitely
during the Mad Max sequence.
Yeah, it definitely sells you on. I don't know. I guess it sells you on the fact that those scenes are taking place in Nevada, but then they cut from that to Alaska, which is another like fake model that they made out of by putting like toy spaceships and toy buildings onto a big sheet of fake ice and stuff. Yeah,
I don't even remember who makes it at the end.
Just Parsifal, because,
oh, that's right, the girl dies, that's
so
sad.
The guy with the eye patch mortally wounds her, I believe.
Oh, that's awful, I forgot.
Yeah.
But no, I remember now, there's, like, the long shot where it was clear she died, and then, like, during the fight scene, he was 50 feet away from where he previously was, and he didn't see that till the end.
Mm-hmm.
He can just win another one, though, if you think about it, really.
Right, right.
Well, that was another kind of cool scene. Wasn't there, like, an implication that she didn't think he'd want to have sex with her because she couldn't have a kid or something? Maybe during their sex scene? Or am I making that up?
I wasn't paying too close attention to their romantic subplot. One of the incongruous things to this movie is that they cast the main character because he looks like Snake Plissken, but then he does all this non-Snake Plissken stuff, like caring for people. I mean, he clearly cares for the midget sidekick and wants him to live. Snake wouldn't give a crap.
I don't know. Snake didn't have any cute sidekicks like that.
Well, Snake put a gun to cute Ernest Borgnine's head, you know?
Yeah, but you're the only one who knew Ernest Borgnine was just an innocent cab driver who stayed there. I and Snake probably assumed he was a butcher of children or something.
Yeah. You know what really doesn't make sense in this movie is why anyone would live on the island of New York if they weren't being forced to in this post-apocalyptic future? Because it's not like there's any, that one gang had to hunt for rats, you know? And also, there's like a URAC headquarters base right outside of the city, which is why the, stormtroopers were going in at the beginning of the movie. They were like kidnapping people either to kill mutants or collect healthy people for human experiments. So why would you hang around near there?
We're missing the fact that they actually inserted a huge subplot with the URAC descent in the ranks. Remember that? Yeah. I mean, there was like this whole
It's kind of inconsequential, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, I don't even remember what happens to her.
There's just like the one URAC bad guy who gets his eyes gouged out that we mentioned. There's like a joke, basically. He has a long portion of the movie having surgery to have his new eyes put in, and then as soon as they're done, one of the other baddies shoots him, and now she's the one in charge. But it's inconsequential to, how many people are going after Parsifal. I really like, by the way, that that just sunk in, huh? Yeah, I love how in that scene where Parsifal's metal-handed sidekick gouges out the bad guy's eyes. He's got that portrait of he's got Guernica behind him, and they didn't trust people to get the reference. They had to have him say hey, you like my Picasso? It's Guernica.
I think he even says more. Yeah,
it's about war and destruction and stuff. Yeah,
having a nice little art history lecture is totally appropriate for this movie.
Yeah. I think this movie's other big expenditure in having the New York feel, besides having that black guy, was having an Asian guy be the leader of the rat hunting gang. Because Asian people are in New York, too.
You know, when I saw it, I'm like, there are Asian people in Italy, I guess. Because, the casting call for the black guy was a big deal.
Right.
Well, what's kind of crazy is though, when you think about what is Zombie?
Yeah.
Has the huge New York end shot, right?
Oh, yeah. But that was technically in the harbor, not in the city itself.
Well, right. But this movie opens with the trumpeter. He lowers the trumpet, and then we see the bridge, and then we see the city, and then we go. I mean, it's the opening it's kind of classy.
It is. It suggests that you're going to see a big movie, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tad pretentious.
I laughed when, the narration is happening and you see the New York skyline and you hear this music and then the trumpet player wanders into frame and you realize that's the music that he's playing.
And then he shows up again later to help out a little, which is...
Yeah, he tells Parsifal and the other two where to go.
It's really exciting in this.
Yeah, sorry, go on.
How, you know, Escape from New York, you have this amazing way of Snake getting into New York.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, continue, please, sir.
Well, yeah, you do. They make a big production out of Snake's glider going into the city and going over models and stuff. But in this, like, Parsifal and the other two show up, they see the black guy. It's the same shot as the beginning of the movie, and the black guy tells them, hey, why did you want to get in there? And they're like, nuts to you, just tell us how to get in there. And then he's like, okay, well, take this one tunnel. Cut to them in the tunnel. There's no transitions. There are very few transitions in this movie. Like, what was the other one? I think, like, when they get into the island, you know, they're in a parking lot full of discontinued buses, and there's a little action scene there.
Yeah.
And then when they get out, it just cuts to, you know, what does look like, you know, a city block or a sound stage or something meant to look like a, you know, burnt up city. But there's no transition for it, and it's kind of jarring.
The thing about the beginning of it that, and when I say beginning, I think probably mean the first 20 minutes. There's action scene after action scene after action scene after action scene. And then it eventually, you know, turns into something else. But all those action scenes, I was just, you know, I was expecting that for the whole movie.
Yeah, I was hoping for that for the whole movie because they're pretty good, actually.
Yeah, and it keeps it moving. Like the bus scene right after that. I mean, the car scene, then, you know, we get a little bit of story, then we get the, yeah, and it just moves, and then eventually that stops. And...
Mm-hmm. It stops at about the time that Parsifal meets Shorty the Midget.
Saves him from the vicious peoples. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they get captured by the Urax, which is pretty weird, because imagine, like, if in the middle of Escape from New York, Snake went back to Liberty Island, and then went back into New York after that. But, you know, they do get captured, taken outside of New York, and they escape, and, yeah, you know. It's interesting the ways this... you know, copies Escape and differs from it. And it kind of copies it in terms of, like, the big strokes, like having to go in to get someone and running into different gangs and the final escape being a car chase. But everything else is really kind of a grab bag. You know, the car chase at the end of After the Fall of New York, it's extremely hokey, but it is sort of shot as well as the other action scenes at the beginning of the movie. Like, they have to drive this car through a tunnel, and, like, there's spikes in the road, and he swerves around the spikes, kind of like Snake has to swerve around the mines and escape. And they have, like, a laser cannon. Like, laser guns are one more future-y thing that just gets thrown into the pile. Instead of Ernest Borgnine getting fried, the monkey guy gets it.
But the monkey guy is not a good guy. That's the other, you know, that's the other thing about this. It's weird is how serious they seem to take it. You know, with the subplots and stuff like that, with the monkey guy being in love with the woman and wanting to, you know, she's the one who's going to give him his child that he always wanted, and stuff like that. But that was my favorite part. Was okay, so the girl, the good girl, or the romantic interest, is left with him to watch the girl who can get pregnant. We don't really know that, though, right? I mean, but anyway. Mm-hmm. They never made a 2020. He knocks her out. Does some weird shit. Don't know what. But when everybody else gets back, it's like she has no memory of her unconscious episode.
Yeah.
And it's like there's like, did anything happen? Is there anything wrong? You know, blank stare, looking around a little. No. And it's like, wait, what? When did you woke up? You were on the ground. What? And I always, I assumed they would go back to it, but maybe, you know, maybe Ape Man, Big Ape, knocked her up. There you go. It's like Humanoids from the Deep.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, this is in some ways the weirdest movie we've kind of. I mean, we got.
I don't know. It's not as weird as the Dungeon Master, but I don't think anything could be.
Well, no, but I mean, Dungeon Master. I was actually going to say Gymkata more than Dungeon Master, because Dungeon Master is from Richard Band.
Yeah.
You know, and those guys. And so, I mean, somebody could conceivably have seen it. But, I mean, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Some of these movies are well known, you know, some of these Italian dubbed movies with down on their luck stars, except this, as opposed to this one, where the leading man, though he's from Connecticut, was never popular. It's not like it's, you know, Clint Eastwood or Lee Van Cleef. It's just some guy who only could get in the movies over there.
Yeah.
Casper Van Dien or something of the 70s or something. But it's just...
Well, I don't know. If it, you know, I wouldn't I almost wouldn't recommend this as an Escape from New York ripoff, because it's not enough about that, or it's not even enough about ripping off Escape from New York, but... If you want to see a combination Escape, Road Warrior ripoff slash Planet of the Apes a little bit, you might want to give this one a go.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be seen to be believed in a lot of ways. Could be worse, I suppose. What's crazy about it is the actual...
It wasn't boring.
No. And the actual good parts are kind of nuts. Like the inventive parts. I won't say they're good in the context of the movie, but the inventive parts, they're kind of nuts. You know how inventive they really are.
Yeah. The tunnel chase at the end, the car dueling at the beginning, the genocide at the beginning. Yeah, really, really, the images of the stupid looking stormtroopers on horseback with flamethrowers rooting out undesirables, it makes an impression.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that
so too does a gang of people with sharp sticks puncturing rats, and I'm pretty sure they used a few real rats there, because this is Italy and they don't have the ASPCA breathing down their necks. But yeah, something about that scene turning into a scene where like one of their group falls over and is beset by ravenous rats who are like hand puppets. This has to be seen to be believed. Yeah, it draws you into its world in a much different. Well, I guess both movies draw you into their world, but in 2019, it's a world of crap.
Yeah, and that's kind of the funny thing about these Italian movies. You know, I grew up on the Leone spaghetti westerns, the Clint Eastwood ones specifically. And then as I got older, I don't know what the first, like, Italian movie I would have seen was. Because you can't count Fellini. You know, you can't count The Bicycle Thief. You have to count the shit they did. And that's the worst thing about Italian movies is, even if they shot them in English, they never shot them with sound. This wasn't shot. Everything was dubbed in later because it was...
It's got that weird removed thing of the actor's lips match the English words, but the voice is obviously dubbed over.
Right. And I mean, and that's a whole nother thing. It's like, does Italian really look that much like English? Because you know some of these guys weren't speaking English.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you can do that with all Italian movies. But, I mean, it's like the, what are they? The Nobody, My Name is Nobody, and with Henry Ford in it, and Sergio Leone produced it, and they did a second one of those, and they're very strange movies. they make some very strange movies there in Italy. To the point that I would actually say Argento's totally normal compared to these guys. I mean, he's working in an established field. These guys are taking every single thing they've seen someplace else.
Yeah.
And throwing it in. I mean, the shots of the city over the opening credits are good post-apocalyptic destruction, right? It's not really believable, though, that anybody lives there.
Yeah, it looks like it's so decimated that nothing could live there.
Right. And then once those little... They have those two... I think there are two shots of it that I remember, and I think they use the same footage. Of the hovercraft over the city.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, is another difference from Escape from New York, because Carpenter never, you know, establishes the city like that again. It's like you're watching AI or something. It looks like it was filmed underwater. It looks like they built a little set in an aquarium and so they could make them fly. They dunked them in water. It's I don't know. I mean,
yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah.
It was never meant to be anything more than a ripoff. So, you know, good enough as a ripoff. Good enough.
Yeah.
So I think that about does it, right?
Yeah. I don't really think. Was there even a musical score? Yeah, there was, but you can't even. It sure
musical
wasn't.
Score. It was kind of generic. Post Giorgio Moroder kind of action synth, but yeah, not really worth remarking on.
No, okay, so there you go.
There you go. So, speaking of foreign films, our next episode will be a look at the Jean-Luc Godard classic Breathless,
and then.
The 1983, was it?
Yep, 1983.
Remake of Breathless, called Breathless, starring Richard Gere.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember who directed that?
It was directed by Jim McBride, who, I think he did The Big Easy. Yes, he did The Big Easy, and he did Great Balls of Fire, and The Big Easy's excellent, and then... after Great Balls of Fire, he sort of disappeared and has not really been seen since. I think he works overseas a lot.
Well, anyways, I've never seen it, but Quentin Tarantino says he likes it just as much as the original. What? What? You want to argue with him? You want to argue with his esoteric, idiosyncratic opinion?
Now, hey... Did you see his top 10 list? It was pretty interesting this year.
He thinks Psycho 2 is better than Psycho 1.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Breathless special. It'll be fun. So, for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
Thanks for listening.